Please be seated. It was a typical university lecture hall. You know the kind. Large, filled with well-used, uncomfortable student seating, and of course, no windows. There was a hint of sweat-soaked running shoes mixed with the familiar scent of ambient anxiety left over from those who had just finished writing their final exams. So this was our final project presentation for our degrees. It was late spring, the day was warm, and it was later in the afternoon than we would have preferred. We were so ready for this all to be over. And finally, we came to the last presentation. The student painstakingly put up what seemed like an unending roll of paper filled with dates, names, events, observations, contexts, and quotes. It circled the room. Fairly phenomenal, actually. But the topic? The history of Christianity. Not a small project by any means. As we walked around the room, the author helped us to see connections and patterns became newly visible as we traced the familiar stories of our tradition. We saw contexts wherein great theologians and humble saints changed the trajectory of Christianity. We saw evolving doctrine, shifting perspectives on heresy, the blossoming and the fading of faith communities, times of abundance, times of complacency, and of course those very well documented times of fear, persecution. And as we became involved in this, I must say, after reading about persecution, we a little eagerly would run to see where the next hint of hope lay in the story. So I was reminded of that day when reading an interview with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. He'd been interviewed by the Muslim scholar Sarah Jacobs. And in the interview, he referred to the work of Alexander Tyler. You're all familiar with him, right? Okay. Alexander Tyler, and you're forgiven for this, was an 18th century Scottish historian. And Williams was caught by his stages or cycles of democracy, not because it was about democracy, but because there was an emphasis on the importance of spirituality and faith in society as a marker of growth and health. So the model begins and ends with a society caught in bondage and tyranny, where hope is dim and there seems little possibility of change. Interestingly enough, in his model, the next stage is growth of spiritual faith, which then leads to great courage. And from great courage, there comes abundance and liberty or freedom. And this moment in the model seems to be the high point. And then the next stage describes how society slips into complacency, apathy, then from apathy to dependence, and cycles back down to bondage and tyranny. Today, Tyler's work might seem just a little prophetic. If we look around, we know that churches are closing at an alarming rate. The Bible is seen as a literary curiosity. Multiple generations have become oblivious to spirituality, let alone Christianity. The growth of white supremacy, a media that throws out fact for emotional and anxiety-creating manipulation of stories. And then there is the growing number of deaths amongst our young people from substance use and suicide. As if to underline this sense of dislocation, a few days ago, Amnesty International, in an unusual move, sent out a travel advisory. It was a travel advisory for people traveling to and within the United States due to gun violence. And it includes a recommendation to avoid malls, schools, large social events, and places of worship. But let's go back to Tyler's model for just a moment. There are limits to such models, and we know this. And looking at it is somewhat useful, and I wonder if we can imagine how various stages would occur at the same time. I also wonder where you think we are at the moment. Is it abundance? Is it complacency or apathy, or all of the above? I wonder. So I believe that the ancient stories in the Hebrew scriptures may have something to show us. The people of Sodom, as described by Ezekiel, similar to Isaiah's implied audience, seem to have access to substantial resources. The sacrificial offerings of bulls, lambs, rams, and goats were costly. To fatten animals for slaughter was even more so. Providing costly resources for sacrificial action without correcting systemic injustice indicates the community cherished the appearance of righteousness over reality. One commentator goes so far as to say, worship had become a form of self-deception that reinforced what the people could comfortably believe. This was leading into complacency. Again, that relationship between abundance and complacency. For the people Isaiah addresses, animal sacrifice was not costly at all. The blood of bulls was too cheap, the life it held was a means to an end. For Isaiah, the blood of sacrifice accuses God's people of a different slaughter, namely their own violence toward their fellow humans. Blood clings to the hands now spread in supplication, and no amount of prayer will dispose God to ignore the evidence of systemic violence, injustice, and oppression. Israel's sacrificial system was not opposed to the demands of justice. It had a strong orientation toward reparation of wrongs, including restitution for damages from economic crimes such as fraud and theft. And while the temple was designed for sacrificial worship, more importantly, it had a larger role in relation to economic and social justice. Isaiah's point is, if the people commit to shared ways of living that promote the welfare and safeguard the rights of all members of society, including the aged and the ill, the widow and orphan, then they will eat the good of the land. However, if they persist in the habit of complacency, which eventually sinks into apathy, then they are the ones who will be devoured by a conqueror's sword. For Isaiah, the antidote to complicity born of apathy has three pieces. One, confront powerful perpetrators of systemic violence. Two, Ensure justice for children who are not one's own. And 3, advocate and ensure care for those whose social and economic status makes them vulnerable to poverty and abuse. Sounds a bit familiar. For Isaiah, these are not vague ideas, but concrete actions necessary for achieving systemic change. And complacency is dangerous. Its child is good work spirituality. And this is perhaps where Tyler's system works well at identifying the implications. The descent from apathy to dependency is often the inevitable fate of good works. The fostered dependence perpetuates systems of injustice. It is both subtle and powerful. There is another implication of dependence. The next phase is a return to tyranny and bondage. And this is where spirituality, hope, courage, abundance, and liberty are subsumed into their opposites of tyranny and bondage. One might think of this as a useful map of our journey towards reconciliation. As we work to break down colonial structures and confront the implications of privilege. But let's leave the Hebrew Scriptures and move into Luke's reading today. The two parables in Luke have something to offer to this conversation. They speak to the importance of spiritual faith and acts of great courage. The first parable isn't really asking us to sell everything and become financially poor. It calls us into a different, shall we say, habit of mind, one where we hold all our possessions, including ourselves, loosely, with open hands. It speaks not only to our possessions, but our habits, our patterns of life. We can, through God's grace, step out of those patterns. From that perspective, the relationship between the two parables becomes even clearer. This new way of thinking prepares us to wait as obedient slaves. We now can more readily respond to God's invitation to action. And while our habit of mind frames our waiting, I have to caution you, this is not passive waiting. It's similar to a kind of kinetic pose, a stance, full of energy. We're poised to move, ready to act, trembling with energy to leap into action at God's direction. We are freed to act immediately once we are unencumbered by our possessions. And this act takes us well beyond Tyler's cycle of society and culture. It places us outside of predictable cycles of history. As kinetic, dynamic people of faith, we are called to see beyond such predictable, destructive patterns. Instead, we respond to Christ's call to action. My prayer is that may our attics be empty and our energy be focused. Amen.